This episode features discussion of kidnapping and the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of children that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
Sean struggled to breathe as the monster's giant hand suspended him in the air, strangling him. Sean kicked at the monster, though his legs were too short to make contact.
The monster didn't want to kill Sean, but he had to. He couldn't risk his prisoner escaping, running to the police.
But then, Sean mustered his last bit of strength and strained to form words.
"I promise,"
Sean croaked, then tugged at the giant fists around his neck to snatch a breath.
"I promise I will never run. I'll never tell anyone. I promise, or you can kill me."
The monster stopped, considering Sean's proposal. He would never run. He would never tell a soul. Then, without a word, the monster let Sean drop to the ground. They had a deal. This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. New episodes of Hostage come out every Thursday.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our second and final episode on the story of Sean Damien Hornbeck, an 11-year-old boy abducted and held captive just 60 miles from his home for nearly 4.5 years.
On October 6th, 2002, Sean Hornbeck was abducted while riding his bicycle about 0.5 mile from his Richwoods, Missouri home. He was kept hostage by a sexual predator in a ground floor St. Louis apartment where he remained a victim of isolation and repeated emotional, psychological, and sexual abuse.
Last week, we covered the events leading up to Sean's disappearance, Sean's horrifying first month in captivity, and the first few days of the over 4-year-long search for Sean by his parents, investigators, and the good people of Washington County, Missouri.
In today's episode, we'll delve into the strange relationship that evolved between Sean and his kidnapper after a deal with the devil that saved the boy's life. We'll also rejoin Pam and Craig Akers in the search for their son and discover how the abduction of Devlin's next victim, Ben Ownby, brought the search for Sean to its conclusion.
Thursday, October 10th, 2002. It had been 4 days since Sean Hornbeck went missing. Pam and Craig Akers, their friends, family, a frenzy of volunteers, police, and FBI investigators had scoured the dense woods of Washington County every day since Sean's disappearance. They hoped to find something, anything, that would lead them to the boy. But the few leads they received proved to be dead ends.
Though Sean's story was big news to the people of eastern Missouri, his disappearance was largely upstaged in the national media. TV screens across the country featured nail-biting and heartbreaking stories, including the intensifying troop movement of the newly dubbed War on Terror in response to the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center the previous year. A string of abductions and murders also swept the country, including the kidnapping of 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart and a series of coordinated shootings by the DC sniper.
Just as Craig and Pam Akers were beginning to feel like they would soon be alone in the search for their son, they got a call from NBC Today Show anchor Katie Couric.
The next morning, Friday, October 11th, they were interviewed live on the most watched morning news show in the country. Sean got his turn in the spotlight.
His picture was displayed on TV screens in millions of households around the country. The Akers family thought that maybe, just maybe, someone out there had seen Sean in the past 5 days, and they would soon have their baby boy back in their arms.
The search for Sean felt renewed. That day, local media outlets reported somewhere between 70 and 100 volunteers had poured into the Akers' newly formed command center. They donned yellow ribbons and campaign-style buttons with Sean's picture on them to show solidarity.
In addition to the new influx of volunteers, the Akers' efforts were boosted by the addition of Bob Walcott, the director of the Laura Recovery Center out of Friendswood, Texas. The organization aids families across the country in their search for missing children. Pam and Craig had contacted the nonprofit on Wednesday when the investigation transitioned from search and rescue to criminal abduction.
That Friday, spirits were high. Volunteer numbers swelled. Thanks to the Laura Recovery Center, the Sean Hornbeck search and rescue team was a well-oiled machine. The day even ended on an optimistic note when the TV show America's Most Wanted posted Sean's picture and the details of his disappearance to their website.
According to Leslie Savage with CBS News, the show, launched by John Walsh after the murder of his only child, Adam, in 1981, quote, has helped to capture more than 1,100 fugitives in the U.S. and 30 other countries, including 17 on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, end quote. Attention from the show was sure to generate leads.
If national media exposure and the advice of a seasoned volunteer search and rescue organization didn't help, then maybe money would. $10,000 was offered by an anonymous donor as a reward to anyone with information that would lead to Sean's safe return. And by the end of the week, that number doubled.
Throughout the weekend, as the Akers family and their refreshed team of volunteers expanded their search to include areas of neighboring Jefferson County, the FBI and Missouri State Highway Patrol forged ahead with their investigation.
They set up roadblocks to fish for any information related to the case and inspected citations issued the day Sean went missing, as well as guest lists at the local prison in Potosi, Missouri. They questioned the Akers' friends and neighbors, the owners of local businesses, faculty and staff at Sean's elementary school, and the students and teachers of nearby Kingston High School. No stone was left unturned.
Leads were also streaming in, between 5 and 9 a day, according to Washington County Sheriff Gary Yount.
One Washington County man was sought on child molestation charges, though investigators had nothing to link him to the disappearance of Sean Hornbeck. Another man, 35-year-old Charles F. Bergner of nearby Leadwood, Missouri, was wanted by authorities on a failure to appear warrant for the first-degree child molestation of 2 boys, aged 9 and 11, in 1999.
Authorities received a tip that Bergner was hiding out in a powder house on an abandoned lead mining property and considered armed and dangerous. Using night vision equipment, officers surrounded the building, but when they entered, Bergner was nowhere to be found.
It was later confirmed that Bergner had been apprehended on Thursday, October 10th. Washington County Prosecuting Attorney John Rupp and members of the Law Enforcement Task Force investigating Sean's disappearance questioned Bergner in regards to the case, but turned up nothing linking the man with the disappearance.
A week had passed since Sean went missing, and all anyone had to show for it were sore muscles and red Missouri mud staining their clothes. Volunteers and investigators were exhausted and frustrated that not one of the leads had panned out.
Again, volunteer numbers waned, and many just wanted to go home and hug their own children tightly. The search moved like the tides, with volunteers and news coverage coming in and going out again just as quickly.
By the middle of the next week, even the law enforcement command post disbanded. They hadn't given up on the investigation, but according to a reporter with the Daily Journal, it was decided that investigators could function more effectively and efficiently from headquarters until they received word on any startling new developments.
Meanwhile, the Akers family never faltered. They appeared as a pillar of strength to everyone still dedicated to the search for Sean. In the weeks following Sean's disappearance, they put their entire savings into the Sean Hornbeck Foundation, a nonprofit that formed from the Sean Hornbeck Search and Rescue Team. They set up their own email tip line. Craig Akers even cashed in his 401k to ensure that the search would go on.
But as weeks bled into months and years, Pam and Craig Akers found it harder and harder to maintain a brave face for reporters, friends, and family. Though they never lost hope that their son was alive, in private they were unraveling.
An exhausted, teary-eyed Craig Akers told an interviewer with 48 Hours, quote, "Nighttime was about the only time when we really did have the opportunity to share our emotions and to share our feelings. Those were probably the roughest times. You're sitting there, alone, and just trying to figure out what happened to your son."
Up next, Sean fights for his own life as his parents scramble to find him.
Now, back to the story.
Michael Devlin effortlessly held the unconscious 90-pound boy in the air by his tiny, delicate neck. He didn't want to kill Sean. He had to. No one could know what he had done to the boy, but the boy's words played over and over again in the monster's mind. "I promise I will never run. I'll never tell anyone. I promise. Or you can kill me."
Devlin dropped Sean to the ground to crumple in a heap.
Devlin paced, cursing loud enough to bring the boy back to consciousness.
He loomed over Sean with gritted teeth. He accepted Sean's promise under one condition. The boy would act as his son and call himself Sean Devlin.
For the next 4 years and 3 months, Sean would be bound to his tormentor, not by physical restraints, but by a promise, a Faustian bargain.
Over the weeks and months following, the monster's paranoia that the boy would run slowly dissipated. Around neighbors, store clerks, and police officers, Sean was a model son. When Sean maintained a believable act, he was rewarded with video games, junk food, or more freedoms. But just as frequently, Devlin reminded Sean what would happen should he ever talk.
Devlin's control over Sean became so complete that he could leave the boy alone in his dumpy Kirkwood apartment while he worked at a local pizzeria, ran errands, and visited family who never had any idea that Sean existed.
Eventually, Devlin even allowed Sean to make a friend, their 11-year-old neighbor, Tony Douglas. In the years that followed, Sean and the Douglas family went to balloon races, malls, movies, and restaurants. They even spent holidays together and regularly had sleepovers. But not once during that time did Sean reveal his identity or give any hint that he might be in danger.
One night, Tony's sister-in-law, Kelly, remembers watching TV with the family, Sean included, and a news report with Sean's picture flashed on the screen. She was taken aback at the image. She panned to Sean and back to the screen, then asked Sean if that was him in that picture. Sean laughed and shrugged off the question in a typical teenage fashion.
Anytime someone thought they recognized him as the missing Sean Hornbeck, his calm, unaffected response seemed to satisfy any concerns, even during a run-in with the local police one night for riding his bicycle after curfew. As far as anyone knew, the Devlins seemed like a normal, happy family.
In an interview with CBS correspondent Troy Roberts, Tony's sister-in-law Kelly noted, quote, "If anything, their relationship was too good. He spoiled him rotten. If he wanted a bike, if he wanted a new game system, a new video game, anything, he got it."
The monster had orchestrated the perfect charade. To their audience of neighbors, Sean and his captor were just a typical father and son.
With this in mind, one can't help but wonder why Sean didn't run or ask for help. He had numerous opportunities to speak up and the freedom to come and go as he pleased, hang out with friends, access the internet, and even have a girlfriend. He was never allowed to go to school, but that didn't seem to bother Sean.
Perhaps because, in reality, Sean's life was far more complicated. He was regularly and repeatedly sodomized by Michael Devlin. Behind closed doors, Devlin occasionally videotaped this torture before putting his dad hat back on for the neighbors.
Sean only had two choices: play a part or lose his life. He was captured at 11 years old and had no idea how to get home. He truly believed that if he escaped, Devlin would find and kill him. His only hope was that he could survive long enough for his parents to find him and end his nightmare.
According to Dr. Mary Lynn Cloytra, a New York University psychologist and trauma specialist, Sean was controlled by terror, reinforced with frequent psychological or emotional manipulation and sexual violence. Dr. Cloytra explained to 48 Hours correspondent Troy Roberts, quote, "Whether Sean went to a pizza parlor, to a friend's house, the message was still in his head."
Sean would have been especially vulnerable to coercion because he was just a child when he was kidnapped. Many kidnapping victims feel damaged by their captors and wonder whether others will see them as damaged goods or ever accept them again.
This abuse and manipulation went on for months, then years. Sean grew visibly older. By the end of 2006, Sean was 15 and had been living with Michael Devlin for nearly 4 years.
And while Sean had grown accustomed to Devlin, Devlin found himself growing bored with Sean. As he aged, Devlin found he was no longer aroused by Sean. The abuse lessened, and Devlin grew antsy.
Then Devlin began coming home later than usual. He would mumble about the possibility of, quote, "doing things with another kid." Sean grew worried. He knew what that meant. The monster was scoping out a new victim.
With a new kid in the picture, Sean feared his days were numbered. He became increasingly defiant. His only option was to fight, to try and stop Devlin from doing to another kid what was done to him for the last 4 years.
The arguments were nearly constant. Devlin was losing his hold on Sean. He wasn't sure if he could stop the teenager from running or talking if he decided to make a break for it. He needed a plan that would ensure Sean's obedience.
One day in January of 2007, as Sean pawed at his video game controller like usual, the apartment door burst open and Devlin stormed in with almost desperate determination, a resolve Sean hadn't seen in Devlin since the day they met.
The monster had found the perfect new kid. He stalked him for weeks and was now ready to make his move. But he needed Sean's help. According to an Associated Press interview with DA John Rupp, quote, "at this proposition, Sean just went ballistic, bellowing at Devlin. There's no way another boy should have to go through what I went through."
The argument went on for what seemed like hours and ended with slamming doors.
Devlin didn't sleep that night. He tossed and turned, his conscience struggling with sexual urges he knew were wrong and the fear of losing control of Sean. He hoped that by making Sean an accomplice in a kidnapping, he would be compliant again, but he didn't know for sure.
Well, Sean didn't sleep either. They both knew that tomorrow, everything would change.
Devlin understood that an attraction to young boys was illegal and, as he called it, sick.
In fact, he divulged in a later interview with Maryland Heights Police Captain William Carson that he didn't realize he was attracted to young boys until about age 13, when he unsuccessfully attempted to molest a younger boy. From that point on, he did all he could to remove himself from the temptation. Nevertheless, temptation was born, and the struggle was excruciating.
According to a St. Louis Dispatch article by Todd Frankel, quote, "This is different from most offenders who tend to commit their first crimes as teenagers and continue for decades until caught."
Devlin stayed away from children and worked nearly his entire life in the back of Emo's Pizza, away from the students who visited after school.
He didn't even quench sexual urges with child porn, like similar deviants do. Instead, he replaced these urges with obsessive behaviors like eating and ballooned to well over 300 pounds. Although this diversion would prove to only be a temporary solution.
Devlin differed further from other child molesters in that he had a relatively normal, happy childhood, free of any sort of abuse. He was adopted as an infant by a hardworking, loving, and devoted Christian family, who went on to have two biological daughters and adopt three more boys. All but one of the boys worked together at Emo's Pizza, under restaurant owner Mike Prosperi, who described the family as good as gold.
The typical child molester is also Machiavellian in nature, a master manipulator. They groom children before molesting them, earning their confidence. According to psychologist Dr. Dale Hartley, author of Machiavellian's Gulling the Rubes, the typical predatory pedophile, quote, either enjoys the ritual of charming and luring children even before they get to the sexual act, or they pragmatically view enticement and grooming as necessary precursors to getting the child to submit.
But Sean's abuser was the opposite. Devlin said in a 2008 interview with agents Kathleen Canning and Melissa Thomas with the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime that he knew he didn't have the social confidence to groom a child, so he just decided to kidnap one.
According to the 1992 Law E Profiling Manual, Child Molesters, a Behavioral Analysis, Devlin's sexual psychology spans a few classifications. He most closely resembles the preferential child molester, or one who has a definite sexual preference for children and need for frequent and repeated sex with children. These molesters also have age and gender preferences for their victims.
Within this category are three major patterns of behavior. Devlin matched two of these patterns. He is introverted, or lacks the interpersonal skills necessary to seduce a child, but he is also sadistic. Sadistic preferential child molesters are more likely to abduct and possibly murder their victims.
Thus, Devlin was truly an anomaly, but he was also a ticking time bomb. Sean had grown out of Devlin's preferred age range. It was only a matter of time before this predator found new, younger prey.
The next day, January 8th, 2007, Devlin got up and went to work, but came home much earlier than usual, a little after 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He looked tired, even ill. He was sweating profusely, but had nervous energy and a crazed look in his eye.
"Get in the truck. Let's go," he said. When Sean refused, Devlin boiled over with frustration. He grabbed Sean and shoved him into the truck. He needed Sean as an accomplice. It was the only way to keep the insolent teenager in line.
Sean had no choice. He couldn't overpower the monster. So he resolved to try and protect the new kid, whoever he was. Sean stayed quiet as they drove out of Kirkwood, about 50 miles west, to a rustic little town in Franklin County called Beaufort.
There, Devlin parked his white Nissan pickup truck by a hair salon on a residential country road. They waited for about an hour and a half. Sean glanced over at the monster, disgusted by what they were doing, but Devlin didn't pay him any attention. His eyes were fixed on a yellow school bus that had just pulled up in front of a row of ranch-style houses down the road.
Like a wolf stalking its prey, his gaze could not be broken. Two children exited the bus. The first was a 15-year-old boy who jogged down the road toward a Chevy pickup truck, but Devlin paid him no mind. Instead, he watched the other kid, a lanky, middle school-aged boy in round, wire-rimmed glasses named Ben Ownby.
Devlin hurriedly cranked the engine and crept his truck up the road alongside Ben. In his haste, Devlin failed to realize that the other boy, 15-year-old Mitchell Holtz, was still outside, sitting in his truck.
Devlin opened the driver's side door. According to author Christina Sauerwein in her book, Invisible Chains, Devlin asked Ben if he knew where a particular person lived. Ben knew that nobody by that name lived on the street. He later said it was obvious the man in the truck was inventing a reason to talk to him. Ben grew visibly nervous.
Devlin was sure the boy was about to run, so he added that the person hadn't lived in the neighborhood long. That seemed to calm Ben down, and he pointed Devlin to a house down the street that a new family had just moved into. Just then, the monster burst out of the truck, aiming his 9mm Ruger P-85 handgun directly at Ben. The boy stood frozen, staring down the barrel. Devlin then firmly put a hand on Ben's shoulder, pulling him toward the open driver's side door. He glanced around to make sure no one was watching as he forced the boy into the truck.
Devlin then forced the boy's head between his knees so he wouldn't be seen as they sped as far from Buford as they could. Ben, shaken and confused, sat wedged between a triumphant captor and his reluctant accomplice, a boy not much older than he was.
Sean tried to calm Ben. He reassured him that as long as he did what he was told, he would be okay. Sean talked to Ben about his favorite foods and TV shows. This seemed to calm the boy, and by proxy, Devlin.
Everything was going smoother than Devlin thought possible. Fear had always been his manipulation tactic of choice. But now Devlin was learning that guilt was a far greater motivator.
The way Devlin saw it, Sean was an accomplice. Now he could never run, or he would end up in prison. A reality Sean understood. He knew his only course of action now was to keep Ben hidden and safe, though safe was a relative term. He knew the hell awaiting Ben when the threesome got home.
When we return, a surprising witness cracks the kidnapping cases.
Now, the conclusion of our story.
On the cold winter morning of Tuesday, January 9th, 2007, Pam and Craig Akers awoke to a gut-churning, familiar news report about an abduction in a nearby town.
It took everything Pam had not to fall apart. The picture displayed in that report was of a boy eerily similar in appearance to her son on the day she last saw him. His hair color, size, age, it was all almost exactly the same. This couldn't be just a coincidence, she thought.
Meanwhile, Ben Ownby's parents, Don and Doris Ownby, were just beginning the same harrowing search for their son that the Akers family had endured for the past 4 years. They'd started the previous afternoon when Ben didn't come home from school.
Ben's father, Don, usually arrived home about 10 minutes before the boy got off the bus each day. But on that Monday afternoon, Ben was nowhere to be found. Ben was a responsible, cautious child. It was out of character for the 13-year-old. So the Ownby family immediately alerted the police.
In the meantime, they contacted anyone and everyone that might know something about where Ben could be, from their neighbors to Ben's school principal and teachers. No one had seen the boy. The Ownby family tried to remain calm as panic rose in their chests.
Over at the police station, Franklin County police officers, headed by Sheriff Gary Telke, responded to the call.
Sheriff Telke grappled with whether or not to put in an Amber Alert. He knew from experience that the most critical component of recovering a missing child was time, but there was no proof that Ben had been abducted.
The Amber Alert System, which stands for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response Alert System, had recently become a federal program following its success in locating 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart in 2003. It allows law enforcement agencies to broadcast information about a missing child via radio, television, the internet, mobile devices, and highway message boards.
According to the requirements listed by the Department of Justice, Sheriff Telke did not have sufficient information to issue the alert, namely a description of the suspect or definitive proof that Ben was experiencing immediate bodily harm. Law enforcement is always slow to issue Amber Alerts for the simplest of reasons. The more they're issued, the more they lose their effectiveness, and Telke didn't want to misuse the alert.
So instead, Sheriff Telke issued an Endangered Person Advisory, EPA, the first of its kind in Missouri. According to the Missouri State Highway Patrol's website, the EPA is a voluntary partnership between law enforcement and local broadcasters to rapidly disseminate information about a missing and endangered person to law enforcement agencies, broadcasters, and the public. It gives police more flexibility than the Amber Alert and is used in cases that don't meet the criteria of an Amber Alert.
But while Sheriff Telke didn't yet have sufficient information about the abductor, he did have Mitchell Holtz, Ben Ownby's 15-year-old neighbor. Holtz recounted every detail of the white Nissan pickup truck he saw speeding away from Ben's house at about the same time the boy vanished.
A truck enthusiast himself, Mitchell was able to give a detailed description down to the tire tread. He noted the rust on the fenders and said the truck's trailer hitch didn't have a ball. The description was so precise that law enforcement wondered if the teen had made it up or if he might have been involved in the boy's disappearance.
However, Mitchell Holtz calmed suspicions when he agreed to take a polygraph test. Then, Mitchell's tire tread report was confirmed with a comparative analysis of tire tread impressions left at the scene of the kidnapping. The only detail the 15-year-old couldn't recount was the license plate number.
Police issued an APB, or an all-points broadcast. An APB is issued by a law enforcement agency to its personnel or to other law enforcement agencies and contains information about a wanted suspect, person of interest, or vehicle of interest.
Once Mitchell's description of the white camper truck aired on the Tuesday morning news, other Beaufort residents came forward with additional sightings of the truck prior to Ben's disappearance.
By Wednesday, January 10th, following nationwide broadcasts describing the missing boy and detailing the truck witnessed at the scene of Ben's disappearance, the leads were pouring in.
Beaufort was a small town, so word of Ben's disappearance traveled quickly, even before the story broke on the news. Volunteers amassed from every corner of Franklin County to search for Ben, including friends, family, and classmates.
Some ventured into the woods to search for Ben, while others distributed flyers that featured Ben's picture and information around the greater St. Louis area. The flyers even made it to Kirkwood, where one was read by the owner of Emo's Pizza, Mike Prosperi.
The flyer wasn't the first time Mike had seen the picture of Ben Ownby. The story of his kidnapping had been all over the news. The TV was always on at Emo's Pizza, blaring a Rams or Cardinals game. That particular week, the same story about a 13-year-old boy kidnapped from nearby Beaufort played over and over again. But one detail about the story made the hairs on the back of Mike Prosperi's neck stand on end.
The vehicle description matched the truck Michael Devlin drove to work, almost to a T. Prosperi was conflicted. The guy he had known for almost 25 years, the same guy whose family regularly invited him to barbecues, couldn't possibly be the same man who kidnapped that little boy. Just to be sure, on Tuesday, January 9th, after he locked up the pizza restaurant for the night, Mike cruised by Devlin's apartment to get a closer look at his white Nissan camper truck.
Mike's gut did somersaults as he walked around the vehicle, identifying each detail from the news report, right down to the red Missouri mud staining the tires. He tried to temper his reaction and think of some logical reason for the red mud. Devlin was a hunter and fisherman. He knew someone with a cabin out in the backwoods. Maybe he'd gone out to the backwoods over the weekend.
But Mike realized Devlin hadn't been to work in the last couple of days, which was very out of character. In his heart of hearts, he knew something was wrong.
He decided to make a stop at the Kirkwood Police Department before heading into work the next day. Though, even as he reported his findings to an officer on duty, he kicked himself for being such a terrible friend. Mike nervously chuckled as he gave his account, noting that he was 99.9% sure that his colleague and friend had nothing to do with the kidnapping.
But Mike's description of his employee's truck was the best match to their witness description, so officers immediately launched a full-scale investigation and notified the FBI.
The next day, Wednesday, January 10th, 2007, Michael Devlin returned to work. He had called out sick since noon on Monday. Mike Prosperi watched him closely that day.
That night, two Kirkwood police officers, Gary Wagster and Chris Nelson, responded to an arrest warrant issued to one of Michael Devlin's neighbors at 491 South Holmes Avenue. Though the individual was not at home, the officers noticed on the way back to their patrol car a vehicle matching the description of the white Nissan pickup truck detailed in the Ben Ownby case APB.
Both officers examined the vehicle in more detail, then hurriedly began knocking on doors at the apartment complex. Along the way, they ran into Michael Devlin, who was taking his trash to the parking lot dumpster. He was initially calm and friendly until the officers asked the man if the truck in question was his vehicle.
Devlin quickly became defensive. Both officers pressed Devlin until he abruptly wished them a good night and hurried back to his apartment. Rightfully suspicious, the officers radioed the station and remained on site to oversee any movement from Devlin's apartment. This was the second tip in one day concerning the 41-year-old pizza shop manager. This was no coincidence.
Officers did not yet have a warrant, so they continued to monitor the apartment throughout the next day. Then, on the afternoon of Friday, January 12th, the case finally took a turn.
FBI Special Agent Lynn Willett and her colleague, Special Agent Tina Kinney, were called in by investigators with the Kirkwood Police Department to check out the multiple tips received about the white Nissan pickup truck owned by Emo's pizza manager, Michael Devlin. Agent Willett was well known within the department for being a human polygraph machine. There was no one better to extract information from a psychologically manipulative monster like Devlin. In tow was a team of forensic investigators.
When Agent Willett arrived at Emo's, she figured her line of questioning would end in a quick lunch. Following up on a tip rarely ended in arrest. However, the first thing she noticed as she entered the restaurant was that Devlin refused to make eye contact. It put Agent Willett on high alert.
The agents calmly made their way over to Devlin, then pulled him aside and asked him if they had his permission to search his truck and if he would step outside so they could talk. He agreed, so Willett gave a nod to the forensics team to move to the inside of the vehicle as they began a casual conversation.
They talked until it began to rain. An agent suggested that Devlin join them in the shelter of their cruiser. Agent Kinney took the front seat, and Agent Willett and Devlin took the back.
They spoke for several hours. Most of the conversation seemed insignificant, but Agent Willett noticed that Devlin made regular mention of a godson named Sean. The agent didn't think anything of it at the time, since the focus of her investigation was Ben.
And whenever Ben came up in conversation, Willett couldn't help but notice the pulse quicken in Devlin's neck. She could see an actual physiological change in the man when she mentioned the abduction. She knew then and there that Devlin was her guy, but she never expected what came next.
Lynn Willett explained to Devlin that the tire tracks left at the scene were positively matched to the tire treads on his truck. The match was as close as a fingerprint. Devlin was quiet for a moment, then burst into tears. He hid his face as he sobbed. He almost seemed relieved. He said, quote, "I'm a bad person."
Michael Devlin confessed to having taken Ben and Sean Hornbeck.
Agents Willett and Kinney, escorted by police backup, made their way to Devlin's apartment at 491 South Holmes Avenue. When they arrived, agents, officers, and Devlin walked up to the unit.
As the door opened, Agent Lynn Willett could see a teenager and another younger boy sitting on the couch playing a video game. She asked the teenager if he was Sean Hornbeck because she would like to take him home.
Sean was stunned. He thought he would never see his family again. He had resigned himself to a life as Sean Devlin. Ben, for his part, rushed to the officers, hysterical. Agent Willett put her hand on Ben's shoulder and said, "You're safe. You are both safe now."
Sean came home to a hero's welcome and quickly earned the moniker the Missouri Miracle. The entire town of Richwoods turned out to show their support. Welcome signs were hung for him around town. Pam and Craig could barely believe their son was back in his old room.
For his crimes, Michael Devlin was sentenced to life in prison. Oddly, investigators said he almost looked relieved to have been caught. Devlin, it seemed, knew he was broken.
On April 9th, 2011, while eating breakfast at Crossroads Correctional Center, Devlin was stabbed with makeshift weapons by two other inmates who claimed to be angered by Devlin's crimes.
Devlin survived the attack and seemed to think he deserved it.
Sean, meanwhile, tried to readjust to life outside Devlin's apartment. It was slow going, but he eventually adapted to life as a free man.
He got a job, a car, and began pursuing a degree in criminal law. He still has a vested interest in offering hope to the parents of children who have gone missing and to hostages recovering from kidnapping situations.
Sean seems willing to dedicate the next part of his life to ensuring he's not the only miracle child that gets to come home. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We will be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Several of you have asked how to help us if you enjoy the show. The best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by David Turk, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Hostage was written by Courtney Rozier and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.